Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:53 p.m. And that is Central Time. Today is May 6th, and it's Friday. So it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. So it's a sea of red on the stock market again today. Now we've had quite a bit of back and forth trading on Wall Street, where it was down, everything was down well in excess of 1%, almost 2% in early trading, got all the way back up to positive, then started to sell off again in the last half hour of trading. Now, I think it's important to pay attention to the Nasdaq. And the big challenge here is that it's very easy to say that it's only one index, but this index has blown every other index out of the water for the last decade. And that's been true regardless of where you're from. So if you're an emerging market investor and you're looking at where to invest, well, you've done well by investing in the USA. The dollar has been steady to rising. The stock market has been benign. Every single dip has resulted in a significant buying opportunity, and then you also have the technology sector that has just blown the lights out with its valuation and ability to generate cash seemingly out of nowhere. And we've often thought about gold in other currencies, but it's much less common to look at stock markets in a range of other currencies. So if you are a euro investor and you've been looking at your European stock markets, well, you're still doing reasonably well because the strength of the dollar has in fact insulated international investors in the USA. And that's equally true for the UK. So when we think then about Japan and their clear effort to devalue the currency, well, at the Nasdaq is still in the region of the 200-day moving average. What about Australia? So Australians investing in the technology sector have done just about as well as their US dollar investors. So what we're starting to see now is that they're all rolling over. So not only is that the dollar trending higher and helping to support assets in US dollar terms from the perspective of an international investor, but that's just not enough anymore to protect investors. And we're still seeing downward pressure on the Nasdaq. And if we just then simply zoom in on eight of these shares, and Fang Man, including Tesla, is also rolling over. We have now got a clear lower high and a lower low. So I think this is a meaningful event. And it looks like the biggest pullback in at least a decade. And I think that these are important facts. What I find interesting right now is the willingness of investors to adopt a philosophical attitude and to say, well, yes, it's a pullback, but we've had pullbacks in the past, and all we have to do is hang on. And as long as we hang on, then the market's going to rebound really emphatically, and everything's going to be fine. And I remember back in 2010 and 11 and 12, talking about a secular bull market and it being having the potential to be one of the biggest bull markets in history. And being very lonely in making those kinds of determinations. Well, fast forward to now, and there are still plenty of people talking about secular bull markets and how bulletproof the technology sector is. And that's all well and good, but we've definitely seen a succession of disappointment coming through from the technology sector. So the ARK Innovation ETFs, they surged higher during the pandemic and peaked in early 2021, and then really started to decline in no from November, and are still weak. Now we had a volatile week. We had the at a really impressive rally on Wednesday. It gave up the entire rally on Thursday and then weak again in here today. Now, the Archaea Innovation ETFs have completely unwound their bull market. But these are most often companies that don't make any money. So they might have big names in there like Tesla, which, despite a very high valuation, does in fact make money. And then we also have this large coterie of stocks that simply do not make money. And when you have no discount rate or a discount rate that goes basically to infinity, well, then any potential profit in the future can be justified. But when you have a discount rate and yields continue to ramp higher, well, then that becomes a different way of looking at these shares. So we can think that the share now, or the ETF, is back in the region of where it was in November of 2019, and that's more or less the upper side of the range that preceded the pop on the upside. But bond yields are now at significantly higher levels than they were back then. In fact, we have to go back to 2018 before we can really see a yield that's higher than 3%. So we've had a meaningful move higher so far this week. Now, it's very overbought, so that means oversold on the prices. And the last time we got up to 3%, we had a significant failure. So if one is making a bull case, then one would have to say that the greatest hope for a clear recovery in the stock market would be for bonds to also begin to recover. But we're only really at the beginning of the interest rate hiking cycle. And I think that when Jay Powell basically said that they're not thinking about hiking by 75 basis points, it wasn't his intention to come off as dovish. But of course, that is what the market thought of. But nonetheless, bond yields didn't really come down and are still above 3% right now. And it's the upper side of the base formation. But more important than that is when we look here at the total return on Treasury futures, and we look at that on a log scale, well, then we have a bit more information because this has been a phenomenally consistent trend. And if we simply look at it on a and look at the what I'm going to find here. There we are. I've got this toolbar that pops up that's invisible to watchers, but it is obscuring the right-hand side of my screen. And if I put a 5-year moving average on here, well, then we can go back and look at all of the history we have available, which is basically a 40-year trend, because this index started in 1982. And at no point in 40 years has the index traded below the 1,000-day or 5-year moving average. And now we are trending down through it. So arguably, this is the end of a secular bull market. And it means that everybody, everywhere, is now going to have to start thinking more about the dividend discount model from the perspective of a discount rate that is likely to trend higher over time rather than to trend lower. And that is going to create significant difficulties for growth. So the growth portion of the market is very richly valued and is afforded a very high valuation. But now we're starting to see that coming back down. Now, the ARK Innovation ETF led on the downside. Then we had the Russell 2000, and it peaked in November of last year and then had a really whopping failed upside break, broke downwards, so that's a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, had a period of right-hand extension, and encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average on the lower side of the overhead trading range, and is now breaking downwards again. This is a completed type 2 top formation. And it's about as textbook gets. So it's now pausing in the region of the 1,000-day moving average in the upper side of the underlying trading range, but this is just tentative evidence of support building, and it would have to do a lot more to really highlight that this isn't a clear bear market. Now, when we think about the other source of, or the other big asset market that people have positions in, well, home builders have pulled back exceptionally sharply. Now, it's very easy to rationalize why the housing market shouldn't fall. We haven't had a big building boom, so there isn't this same surplus housing stock available that we would normally have at the top of the market. But we are at affordability levels that are getting difficult. And if you have affordability levels that are high and you don't have a lot of inventory, well, then to continue to support higher prices, successively higher prices, then you need leverage and you need people to be able to access capital. So financial conditions are going to be a really important part of this equation. Now, the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index is still trending higher and doing so in a really aggressive manner. But it's also coming from exceptionally low levels. So the higher this goes, the tighter conditions are getting. But we're now only now at levels that preceded the pandemic. So conditions are tightening now, but they're nowhere near as tight as where they have been in the past. So we're well on the way to tightening, but we're certainly not there yet in terms of the kinds of restrictions to access to credit that would normally be associated with tight conditions. And because I've done so many home renovations recently, I've had money thrown at me every time I go to buy materials. So Home Depot, Floor & Decor, Lowe's, they're all offering 12-month, 18-month, or even 2-year interest-free credit. When we think about the buy now, pay later phenomenon, this is now everywhere. So we have companies like Affirm that have profited, or at least the profit might be the wrong word. They certainly did well to come through with a high valuation to their IPO, but now the shares trending down. And it's not necessarily because there's a large number of defaults, but more because there's an intense amount of competition. And unfortunately, this is quite difficult to monitor in an easy way with official statistics, because credit card delinquencies was one of the real barometers for risk taking heading into the credit crisis. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody was watching it, but it was certainly something that was, in retrospect, quite obvious. And we're just not seeing that same. I do wonder whether it's going to offer the same signal, on this occasion. Because when we think about the credit card delinquencies, it's now still at exceptionally low levels. So there's no evidence of stress in the consumer. And we're not going to have a recession unless there's stress on the consumer. And with the quantity of money that's being thrown at consumers, then this talk about tighter financial conditions, it's really more of a financial markets way of thinking about it rather than a consumer way of thinking about it. But it is consumers are driving the US economy. And the Federal Reserve is exceptionally active now in raising rates relative to everywhere else. So Europe is only beginning to talk about moving out of negative rates and into zero. The Bank of England did raise rates this week. But what was, I thought, particularly interesting is that the Federal Reserve said that their decision was unanimous. And they intend to raise rates by another 50 basis points going forward. And the stock market is weak heading into that. Now, back in January, I was quite clear in stating that I thought it was going to be one and done, because I just did not think that the Fed would be able to raise rates because I thought the stock market would have already sold off aggressively. I didn't calculate. Or I didn't appreciate how much liquidity was in the market and how available credit is. So, having gone through all of this process of home renovation over the last few months, I've got a much better understanding of just how much money is floating around out there. And I think I didn't really get that kind of idea when I was buying this house. What's interesting is that I got an email yesterday from my bank, and they told me, "Wow, you did such a great job buying your house, and it's now where you bought your house is up 20% in the last year. So this is how much additional credit you have available to you." So it's not just retailers, but it's banks as well are starting to throw money at people when they think that they have the credit available to them. Well, that's also then why the Federal Reserve feels e at ease with raising rates. The stock market is pulling back, but it hasn't pulled back in nearly as aggressive a manner as it did, for example, in 2018. And that suggests that we will continue to have upward pressure on bond yields, upward pressure on the dollar, and that stocks will continue to pull back until the Federal Reserve breaks something. So the dollar now was a little softer in here today, and it's at the upper side of its range. It's, I think, particularly interesting that both the dollar and the 10-year yield are at exactly the same point in their trends. They're both at the upper side of very lengthy ranges, and on each of the occasions that they got to these levels in the past, they failed. So that also is why the stock market has not sold off as aggressively, because investors are looking at these trends and thinking, well, this isn't the best time to sell because we've already had a good size pullback, and bond yields and the dollar are at points where they have reversed in the past. And if the dollar starts coming down and bond yields start to come back down, well, then that's going to ignite a really strong relief rally on Wall Street. And I think that's probably the correct conclusion. But then, of course, there's the potential that they don't stop. And we're in this rather difficult environment because if the dollar continues to rally, it's going to put pressure on everything else. So we looked at how do European stocks look from our, we looked at how US stocks look from a European perspective. And the Euro stocks, having pulled back violently, is now back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But then we should think about how do European stocks look from a US perspective? And they're well below the 1,000-day moving average. And when we look at this over the longer term, well, it's been an exceptionally choppy trending environment. It's not like there hasn't been an uptrend. It's been incredibly inconsistent and exceptionally difficult to make money from. And now it's coming back down again. So it's not attractive from the perspective of an international investor. Then, when we think about the FTSE 250, we're presented with a similar phenomenon. From a US perspective, it is back on its lows. So international investors aren't going to be attracted to US, or to, excuse me, UK equities when the pound is coming back so abruptly. And the pound was particularly weak in here right now. So the Federal Reserve was completely unanimous in their decision to hike in here this week. And the Bank of England wasn't. So they had two members that said, don't hike at all. They had six that said, yeah, we need to hike. And then there was a couple of more said, we need to hike aggressively. Now that's a lot of indecision. That's obviously, if you want to have a line of best fit, then the majority were saying that they needed to hike rates. But this is, I think, a rather difficult scenario. When we think about markets that have predominantly got floating rate mortgages, it really does become problematic in a rising interest rate environment. So this was an irrelevant consideration over the last 40 years because interest rates were coming down. Now that the trend has been broken, and we're starting to see the total return on bonds rolling over, and that now they're trending down through the 1,000-day moving average. If this isn't the end of the secular bull market in bonds, it's a really big shakeout, and it's going to become a much less consistent market in future. So buying the dips won't always work. And even then, the rallies will peter out faster, or we're going to have exceptionally choppy action. And I suspect that that is what we're going to have, is exceptionally choppy markets. So we're not going to have the same kind of rhythmic trending environment. Now, from an economic perspective, higher oil prices are a tax on consumption. And the good news is that with energy, there are solutions. If high oil prices are problematic, well, then you can use less. You can drive less. You can use alternative fuels for heating or for electricity. So it's not easy. It's not like you can build new power stations overnight. But there are available solutions, and it's not something that lasts indefinitely. But as long as we have high energy prices, it's going to be a tax on consumption. Then you have the additional point that if you've got a floating rate mortgage and interest rates go up by 1%, well, then you have a problem. So let's just think about the fact that the average house in the UK is about 400,000, and typical interest rates are about 2%. So your repayment would be about $1,500. And if it goes up to 3%, well, just by doing nothing, then people have to find an extra £286 every month. Now, of course, the repayment period tends to be 25 years in the UK. So that's not going to change the calculation in the short term. But the reality is that this is an additional tax on consumption. So not only do people have to contend with higher energy prices, they have to contend with higher mortgage prices. So this is going to cut into the ability of people to spend. Then, on top of that, because you have this indecision at the central bank level, because they're terrified of tanking the property market. So, if that's the case, they're reluctant to raise rates a lot, but that's putting downward pressure on the currency. And of course, because energy is imported and lots of food is imported, well, then that's putting downward pressure on the currency, but upward pressure on everything else. So this isn't simply a UK phenomenon. We have a similar type of phenomenon in Australia, but Australia is much closer to energy independence and food independence than the UK is. And Canada has exceptionally high prices, but also is independent in food and in energy. So there are these issues fall primarily hard in European countries. Then let's just think about Germany. So Germany isn't energy independent, and it's not food independent either. So when we think then about Germany, it's about the value of the euro pushing up everything else. And they don't want to, well, they don't have control of their interest rates, and the ECB doesn't want to aggressively hike rates. But we've definitely seen that bund yields are starting to push higher, and we're up to 1.13%. So this has been a really profound move. Back in March of 2020, we were about almost negative 1%, and now it's breaking on the upside. This is a new high. We haven't seen a new closing high like this since 2014, and it really does begin to suggest that the German Bund yield has broken out, and this could potentially be the end of what has been a phenomenal bull market in bonds. So it's going to be more difficult to source cheap capital in future. Or at least it's going to be more difficult to source cheap capital until central banks relent. The problem with having a mountain of debt is that you can't really easily raise rates. And the Federal Reserve is doing it right now, and they're not paying attention to the fact that the cost of servicing the outstanding debt is going to ramp higher over the course of the next year. Now, the US Treasury is issuing fewer bonds. They don't have a lot of choice because they can't really afford the interest rates right now. We're not yet at a point where the governments have decided they're going to spend less money. Now, until we start to see real strong, balanced budget initiatives, and we had that in 2011, the Tea Party movement, that was basically their whole thing, was that they wanted to stop egregious spending and they wanted to put in balanced budget memoranda into governments. And they pretty much succeeded. And it resulted in the dollar starting to firm and bond yields starting to come back down. And nobody is championing that today because people are just, everybody in Europe, they understand what that means in terms of the deflationary forces that it unleashes. When in Ireland back in 2010 and 11 and 12, there had to be a massive fiscal consolidation. And public sector employees were forced to take pay freezes. Some had to take pay cuts. And then all of the public service employees had to pay more for their own pensions. And that kind of spending was enforced upon Ireland because of the massive debts that the government had to take on as a result of the credit crisis. And it created a significant deflationary force. And the fiscal austerity that Europe implemented, well, that was a really significant event. And then what we had right across Europe was this rise of populism and protest movements. And we had the rise of the protest movement in the USA with a massive polarization and real threats to social cohesion. And even in the French election, basically, you have the electorate just voting to keep Le Pen out of power. But this is not the first time that she's been in a presidential election. So there is a hard core of support for her policies. Now, all of these types of protest movements, they grew out of the fiscal austerity. They grew out of the fact that quantitative easing was great at inflating asset prices and terrible at creating solutions to some of the debt issues that regular people had. And most particularly, there was no trickle down, and then there wasn't any real easy way to get people that were underemployed back into gainful employment. So living standards continued to deteriorate. Now, when we think about all of that experience, where we've had incredible political upheaval and the kind of cooperation and the willingness to accept real hardship in response to the debt issues that are emerging, there's just no willingness to accept that among the global population. Most particularly not in Europe, and definitely not in the USA either. So, if that's the case, where is the budget discipline going to come from? If you can't find it voluntarily, it will have to be imposed. And rising yields are a way of imposing it. So this is basically the rise once more of bond vigilantes. Now, when we think about what we have in the yield curve, this type of environment is, I think, particularly interesting. We have the yield curve spread now up to 41 basis points, and it's starting to trend higher. Now, it was inverted in early April and then didn't hold. So we're definitely seeing that investors are really anxious to get out of long-dated bonds. So when we look at the spread between the 10-year and the 3-month, well, then this is trending higher in a really impressive manner. It's up to 232 basis points. This has been a really big move over the course of the last few weeks. Now, this is normally coincident with a really significant economic recovery, but instead, right now, what it is emblematic of is the selling pressure at the long end of the curve. So when we just look at this 3-month yield, if you're a bond fund manager, you don't have a choice. You have to go as short dated as possible and pick up the 81 basis points every 3 months because you can't own long dated bonds. So I think this kind of divergence where we now have the Fed funds rate at 1%, and we have 3 month yields at 81 basis points. And that's an unusual scenario. What it suggests is that there is profound demand for short-dated debt. And it's the only way that investors can really protect themselves against inflationary forces. And that's the only way to run a bond portfolio at present. Now, when we think about the inflation that we're seeing, well, we can think about it in terms of supply and demand, or we can think about it in terms of money. I have a lot of sympathy with the view that this is a monetarist event, that we printed a whole ton of money and it created inflation because it simply devalued the available stock of currency. To me, at least, that just makes sense. But then we also, of course, have the supply disruptions as a result of the pandemic and then the war in Ukraine. Now, what I also find rather interesting right now is we're still seeing the Russian market being sanctioned, and the number of sanctions continues to rise. And this is, sorry, that's the CRTX, which is not trading right now, but the Russian traded index also pulled back and has been reporting prices. And it looks like at least a partial recovery. Now, I don't know when it's going to fully recover, but it's well off the lows. And the ruble has strengthened. So Russia made the decision to invade Ukraine. And we should be asking, rather than, I think there was a knee-jerk reaction to think that it was an irrational move. And I just don't think that that's credible. You don't invade and stoke the ire of your neighbors and give up major trade positions for no reason. So they're doing it for a reason. So the big question then is, what's the reason? I think that it's more to do with energy. That Russia is looking around the world, looking at the trend of technological development, looking at the increasing commercialization of advanced technologies in the energy sector, whether that is using lasers to drill self-cauterizing drill holes for exceptionally deep geothermal wells, or whether it is the evolution of small modular reactors, or whether it's going to be the eventual firing up of the ITER fusion project at the end of this decade. So Russia can see the writing on the wall, and their geopolitical position is very much dependent on being a dominant force in the global energy sector. And energy independence is a significant theme. Now, they probably could see that the trend was towards greater independence in Western Europe and the creation of the credit or the carbon credits system has also been a very much a European creation, which is aimed exclusively at encouraging energy independence. Now, we might talk about it in terms of saving the planet, and the sound bites are all about carbon mitigation. But the reality is that renewable energy is really about energy independence. And if we view it in those from that perspective, then it becomes much clearer that if an energy exporter is being threatened by that kind of evolution, well, they don't have a lot of choice. They're going to try and do something to reorient their economy. So what they're doing right now is they're trying to force Europe into a reversal, or at least to try and highlight to Europe just how difficult it will be to do without Russian exports, and to try and highlight the challenges that exist with the renewable energy sector. And unfortunately for them, they have probably more highlighted the fact that Europe has been suspicious of Russia for a long time. And there was certainly a trend towards Germany in particular having a much more friendly attitude towards Russia. And Gerhard Schroeder is now persona non grata because of his friendly relationship with Russia. But considering that Russia, that Germany had to incorporate all of Eastern Germany and a large communist-leaning population, then their more positive attitude towards Russia at the time was just simple realpolitik. And Russia probably thought of that as something they could depend on, and obviously they were wrong. So carbon credits are still really firm. And I tend to think of carbon credits as offering bond-like characteristics. They are a government-sponsored market. And if the price falls, like it did just a few weeks ago, then they'll change regulation. And they'll just make fewer of them. And that will create a limited supply environment and push the price back up. So we're definitely seeing a very clear revolution in the energy sector. Now, in the short term, that is creating higher prices. And those higher prices are designed to further the aim of energy independence. So what we're more than likely going to see over the course of this decade is a massive revolution in the energy sector. And the markets that will do best are going to represent state-sponsored capitalism. And that's really what the energy revolution is about. So the intrusion of the state into investment decisions is going to become progressively more powerful. But that's definitely helping the energy sector. And natural gas prices have been really especially firm this week. Now, they did pull back a little in here today, but they're still closing the week at $8. So, this has been a really impressive move this week. And coming off a little at the end of the week, but it's a base formation completion. And really, a sustained move back below $6 would be required to question the trend overall. Then we have what's going on in China. And the Xi regime is clamping down on any dissent to the COVID zero policy. In a communist environment, politics rules every other consideration. So it's a political decision, and it's I think realistically they don't have a lot of choice because they can't change policies in the middle. If China had decided that they were going to accept and live with the coronavirus 2 years ago, then it would have been a short, sharp wave through the economy. But they didn't make that decision, and now they have to live with that decision. Every country has had to live with whatever decision they made. There isn't really any going back. So China is living with its COVID zero policy. There is no way that they're going to change that. And it also means that they're not going to be as eager to roll out vaccines because that would be a weakening of the COVID zero policy. They're just going to try and ensure that more people don't get it. Now, one of the big challenges with that is that some of the biggest critics of the Chinese regime look on that and say that China is going the way of North Korea, that they don't want people visiting, they don't want people leaving, they are clamping down on how people can move around the country, and they're not interested in trade and commerce any longer, but in control and telling people what to think. So this is obviously a challenge within China, and they're going to have to do something in order to ensure that the economy doesn't just collapse. Now, the state-owned property sector pulled back exceptionally sharply earlier on this year, then rebounded impressively, and now it's starting to come back down again. So the Shanghai Property Index has pulled back sharply over the last couple of days, and the renminbi is being devalued. So China's economic malaise isn't about to rescue the wider economy, but the devaluation of the currency at least suggests that liquidity is starting to be made available. But the last thing China wants is another property boom, and they already have a problem with how high property prices are because it's threatening social cohesion, and prices have climbed well beyond the reach of regular citizens. So this is a problematic factor for China. What that suggests is they're going to provide liquidity, but not on the scale of liquidity provision we've seen before. Then, if we think about the H share index in Hong Kong, it continues to pull back. Now, we had a really impressive rebound from that 6,000 level about 2 months ago. And now it's coming back down again. Now, if it fails to hold the low, well, then there's the potential it's going to come back down and test the 5,000 level. But investors are impatient now. They want to see additional liquidity. They want to see China beginning to ease up. And if China's government is less eager to do that, well, then that's going to put downward pressure on everything. When we think about the markets and we think about valuations where they are, well, then liquidity is the big arbiter of whether prices go up or down. And the total assets of central banks is incorporating China's central bank and the devaluation of the currency. So we've only just started to see interest rates rising. And now we've already seen that the size of central bank balance sheets has contracted by 2 trillion. And that's before balance sheet runoff really even begins. So this is pointing towards a lot less availability of credit. And it's a meaningful move overall. And it is clearly showing up on the log scale chart. So we're definitely seeing more money starting to come out. And this is obviously problematic from asset prices generally. Historically, when the size of central bank balance sheets has contracted, it has contributed to a volatile environment in the broader market. Then we have the additional fact that because bond yields are coming up so quickly, it's contributing to volatility. Now, the VIX index got up to 35 in here over the last week and closed a little lower in here today, but 35 is still pretty elevated. And the MOVE index for bonds is close to the highs that we saw back in 2020. We're in an environment which doesn't happen all that often, when both bonds and equities fall together. So that plays havoc with algorithmic trading. And the more often it occurs, the more it has to be incorporated into models. So when you think about how do models get created, you think about a model and you look at available information and you have to think about the kinds of volatility events you're willing to tolerate. And then you give probabilities to volatility events that could happen. Well, when something happens once in a decade, then you give it a low probability. When something happens 10 times in a year, well, then you have to give it a higher probability. And when it has a deleterious effect on the portfolio, well, then you would have to start programming your algorithm to look for these kinds of scenarios and either enhance the hedge or go outright short. And I suspect that that is what's starting to get incorporated into algorithms now, because the number of days on which both bonds and equities have fallen together has risen significantly in 2022, and it was a very rare event before now. So we're definitely getting to a point where some funds are going to find a very difficult time doing better. There've been lots of news stories about the success of macro funds that are up 60% or 100% in this year so far because they were on the right sides of the trades. Nobody likes bragging about taking big losses, but there's definitely been big losses. There's also a clear tendency to want to try and buy the dip. On Thursday, there was a multi-billion dollar cash infusion into those ARK innovation ETFs. People still want to buy the dip. So, if central banks are going to be somewhat inhibited from raising rates, and inflationary pressures are going to continue because there is basically a proxy war going on between the energy consumers and the energy suppliers. And that's going to inhibit their ability to either reform or to raise rates. Well, then gold is the kind of environment or the kind of asset that should do better. And oil prices also remain firm. But gold is most particularly doing better in currencies other than the US dollar. So it's still firm against the Australian dollar. And maybe it looks better. We get more perspective if we look at the longer term chart. And let me make sure that I can type in the right place. So gold prices in US dollars are firming from the region of the upper side of the underlying range and the 200-day moving average. And this has been already a lengthy consolidation. Against the Australian dollar, we continue to see a sequence of higher reaction lows. Now, in Brazil, they've raised rates by 1,000 basis points in the last year, and still the price of gold is pushing higher and bouncing from the lower side of the range. In Canada, it's also very similar in complexion to the US market. From a Euro investor's perspective, it broke out to new all-time highs already this year and continues to consolidate. The significant depreciation of the pound this week has taken gold up to the upper side of its range. So, gold is doing better in a whole host of currencies. It's just not firing right now in US dollars. But that's probably only a matter of time. And particularly as the renminbi is devalued, it's going to start creating demand for hedges. And the greater the political emphasis on the economy, then the more demand there'll be for hard assets. Now, as we move forward and we think about the repercussions of moving into a trending environment in terms of interest rates and inflation, and the unwillingness of populations to accept the hard medicine necessary to kill inflation. Well, it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. People have to experience the problems of inflation, and they have to try some of the politically expedient solutions first. Well, the most politically expedient solution to inflation is control on prices. Now, we have that in Europe in isolated cases in the electricity markets. Whatever happens in terms of natural gas prices, they can't raise electricity prices in an aggressive manner. And that was the reason why so many of the independent electricity providers in the UK went bust earlier this year. Well, what happens when they start doing that with oil and they start subsidizing oil prices? Because lots of emerging markets do that, but developed markets don't generally do that, but they might start. And California is talking about, they were talking about sending checks to people as a stimulus to try and help them afford gasoline, and that might now be delayed until October. But the trend is clear. So it looks quite likely that that's going to be tried first. And if we look at history and the early mid to mid 1970s, those price controls work. They do bring down inflation just by not allowing the price to rise anymore. But they tend to be expensive. And as the cost mounts, well, and inflation does come down, well, then governments abandon them. And then the price structure tends to recover. And you get a really significant jump in inflation. And then inflation becomes truly problematic. And then you have to see people again experiencing a big inflationary problem. So I think this is what we're looking at, that we don't have the political will to hike rates sufficiently high enough to kill inflation. We'll see recessions beginning well before that becomes the case. And subsequently, we might even see price controls. And I think that that is more likely in places like the UK to start first than it is in the USA to start first. But I think it is more likely than not that countries are going to start adopting these kinds of policies within the next couple of years. So that will be basically storing up energy in commodity prices, just like it did in the 1970s. And subsequently, we'll start to see eventually some appetite for the kinds of controls necessary to quell inflation. Now, the question that's been at the back of my mind for the last week has been, can we have value without values? Because in the 1960s, we had the sexual revolution, and we had there was the civil rights reforms, and there was more licentiousness in terms of drug use. And then there was the potential for revolution, and governments became afraid, so they started spending rather than being fiscally austere. And there's a technological element to all of this as well, because as technology enhances productivity, and then it also threatens the social fabric, or allows alternatives and less onerous social mores to take over, because there isn't the same reliance on brute force and the energy of individual people and their muscles. So it creates less demand for physical work, and you're more of a concentration on brain power. But nonetheless, if interest rates rise and we need to be more diligent and live smaller lives, it's going to create more conservative people. And I do question, and I guess I'm wondering, would we need to see a revival of, I think, more disciplined ways of living and less reliance on instantaneous gratification, before we start to see appetite for the kinds of measures required to quell inflation? Now, the one thing we do know is that the value sector is now outperforming growth, by a pretty substantial margin. And it has clearly broken out of its base formation. And when we think about the gold shares relative to the NASDAQ, well, gold shares have had a difficult period and they're pulling back over the course of the last week, but still holding the move above the 200-day moving average relative to the NASDAQ, and then gold shares relative to gold is an additional interesting chart, because gold has clearly outperformed over the last few weeks. We're still not at a point where investors are willing to differentiate between various opportunities. The one thing that people are willing to buy right now is energy, and energy stocks continue to outperform in a very clear manner. And there's obviously a good reason for that, because it's the center of risk in the war with Russia. So Shell and BP and Chevron and Exxon are all trending higher. They have got the benefit of strong balance sheets and windfall profits and a rising commodity price environment. So despite the risk and the deleveraging we're seeing in other parts of the market, the energy sector continues to do well. But we're in a still a difficult environment where the risk of deleveraging is real. And the higher that these commodity prices move and the higher that bond yields move, then the greater the pressure that comes to bear on all other speculative assets. And I think that's also particularly relevant for Bitcoin. So the price bounced today from the 35,000 level, and it's bounced from this area a couple of times this year already. So it is something that investors are keeping an eye on. But it's going to have to do better than this. It's going to have to rally and push back above the 200-day moving average to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And the price of Bitcoin is very heavily dependent on available liquidity. The blockchain and the ability of the blockchain solution to offer an alternative to the global financial apparatus is still to be proven. But the value of the coins is very much dependent on liquidity. And there has been a wall of money moving into the non-fungible token sector, which many view as early stage and therefore capable of delivering the kind of outsized gains that Bitcoin was once capable of. So we're certainly still in a corrective phase in the cryptocurrency sector as well. I do think that we're going to need to have a growth scare before central banks relent. I think that we're going to have to see them be able to at least sound some form of victory over inflation in the short term before we see a meaningful low come into stock markets. But I think that we are moving out of a total reliance on the performance of a small number of shares, and that real assets are going to become progressively more important. But of course, the continued performance of defensive sectors, well, that's obviously also a worrying sign that when the defensive sectors are those that are doing best, well, then you have to know that there's something else that's worrying investors in just about everything else. So the biotech index is still trending downwards. But then we have other companies within it, or within the broader pharmaceutical sector, that continue to trend higher. And it really does come down to dividends, cash flows, strength of balance sheets, and the fact that they're not trading, or their growth isn't dependent on the continued prospering of small technology companies. And pharmaceuticals generally tend to be exceptionally defensive. So we're seeing energy and portions of the pharmaceutical sector and the consumer staples sector still doing well. And they will not peak. They usually are the last sectors to peak. And shipping companies also are continuing to do well. And the Baltic Dry Index continues to march higher. If we have these difficulties between or the cooperation between China and Russia relative to just about everybody else, it's going to create demand for new trade routes, and that represents an inefficiency and duplication. So it means more money being spent, more debt, and then it really is a contributing factor towards more inflation. And these are factors that interest rates don't change. So we're certainly in an environment where inflationary pressures, some can be dealt with, some can't. And we're going to see an increasing political focus on those that can be dealt with. And any kind of solution in those politically driven inflationary measures will be celebrated and will be cause for somewhat lower interest rates, and we'll get occasional strong rallies, just like we did in the 1970s, where we have very cyclical markets where they go up a lot and down a lot and then not very far in either direction, and we get these lengthy ranging phases. That's what the potential is if inflation isn't brought under control very quickly. But I don't think anybody really thinks that the Federal Reserve has the stomach to raise rates to where they need to be. Now, Brazil has raised rates by 1,000 basis points, and they still haven't been able to get in control of inflation. So, does anybody really think that the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates by 1,000 basis points? Are they going to take rates to 10%? I think we would have a very deep recession way before we ever get to that kind of juncture. So that is basically sowing the seeds for a longer-term inflationary problem. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.